Laptops, iPads, smart pads, and other technology, how it's all changing the way kids learn. Maine launched its first in the nation student laptop program in the fall of 2002. What began as a program for 7th and 8th graders has expanded a great deal over the years. Most Maine high schools now provide laptops or iPads to students, and some school districts are introducing the technology as early as kindergarten. One study showed that reading scores for middle schoolers have improved since the introduction of the devices, but other studies have shown little effect on student achievement. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll look at the impact of technology in the schools. How do we measure its effectiveness? What technology seems to work best, and what are the drawbacks, if any? Maine Calling heads into the cloud, iPad in hand. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For those of us of a certain age, classrooms conjure up images of chalkboards, erasers, mimeographs, and microfiche. Well, for today's students, going to school means working on iPads, collaborating with smart boards, and wondering if the Wi-Fi is working. There have been multiple initiatives in recent years to give Maine students greater access to technology in the classroom. But tight school budgets can make this a contentious issue. Today, we'll be looking at how technology is used in Maine classrooms from kindergarten through high school. With me in the studio, Jeff Mao, who's former Learning Technology Policy Director for the Maine Department of Education. Anne McDonald, she's a Technology Integration Specialist for the Falmouth School Department. And Andrew Wallace, Director of Technology for the South Portland School Department. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts or questions about technology in the classroom? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to the Maine Calling Facebook page, because we are so technologically savvy here at Maine Calling. No, I'm just joking, but you know, we have to read all those things. So I'm really happy you all are all here. And Jeff, I have to start by asking you about an article in just this morning's Portland Press Herald, in which a technology consultant, Stan Smith, charges that Maine grossly overpaid for iPads, comparing a contract negotiated with Los Angeles. You negotiated the deal. What's the response to his analysis?
We looked at some of the numbers he gave us and really didn't know where they came from. I think the challenge is that there was no context. We're also not really familiar with the specifics of what Los Angeles asked for. And we know here in Maine, when we went out to a large public bidding process, that what we were provided back were 17 different bids from a lot of different companies. The iPad bid in particular was the lowest cost of all of those bids. It was less expensive than the bids that we've done in the past. So we feel like we got a great deal. And I think the thing that people have to remember is that what we bid for was not to buy a bunch of iPads. It was to buy equipment, but also a huge number of services. Apple as a company and a partner to us here in the state of Maine has over a dozen full-time employees dedicated to the project. They've got, support services. I was just over at the repair depot this morning, so there's folks over there who are working under the project, so there's a lot of jobs involved. So it's not just equipment. It's a whole host of services that are supporting our teachers and our kids. So it's tough to look at these things and then compare that, say, to a retail cost of a piece of equipment that you buy in a store.
Okay, well, I'd like to move on now, because this Maine Calling program is really designed and intended to be about how technology is changing how children learn. And so, Jeff, I'd like you to give us a sense of how things have changed since 2002, when Maine made such big news with the laptop initiative, first state in the nation to match one child to one laptop in the 7th and 8th grades. What do we see now out there?
Well, I think some of the big changes when we think about where we were when we started in 2002 and where we are today is that, the ubiquity of Internet access is hugely changed. In 2002, we were excited that students might have a dial-up connection at home. And today, we have cyber cafes and McDonald's with free Wi-Fi. And the speed of the network has significantly changed the kinds of things we can do. So one of the things that computers do well is communications. And so back then, the communications could be some text messages, some email, things like that. And today, we routinely will see kids and adults video conferencing and talking to people around the globe. So really kind of breaking down distances. And, I think some of the more kind of prevalent technologies in the consumer world, none of them existed when we started. So things like social media, YouTube, all of those things, they didn't exist, and today they do. And I think today teachers are looking at how we can leverage all these different technologies for the benefit of kids.
Anne and Andrew, I want to ask each of you how technology is utilized in your school district. Are kids from K through 12 going home with their own device, or some kids? What's going on in Falmouth?
We have our students K to 5 have access to iPads during the school day, but it's not one-to-one. We have one iPad for every two students. They're shared, and they're used very differently, even K2 to 3-5. K2 is the teachers use them more in centers, and there may be 5 kids on iPads at one time while the teacher is teaching a math lesson to another 5, and another 5 are doing something else. 3-5, they share them more and do some more whole class activities, but everything is shared. Sixth grade, we have one-to-one with the old MLTI laptops, but they don't go home. And then 7th and 8th, we have the MLTI laptop program. And in our high school, we have a bring-your-own-device program. So we don't supply laptops, but we do have access to laptops for students who don't have them.
So in Falmouth, most kids have families, or a great number of kids have families who can afford their own device, but those who for some reason cannot do have access to a school laptop. Let me ask you, Andrew, Andrew, in South Portland, how do you utilize technology? What do the kids have access to at different grade levels?
Sure. In South Portland, all of our students 6 through 12 have access to their own iPad. Similarly, the 6th grade students don't take them home. It's sort of our transition year. Kind of fits with the theme of transitioning from elementary into middle school. At the lower levels, we have a mix of PCs and Macs and iPads. So on paper, we're about a one-to-one, but as Ann mentions, the learning at the lower levels tends to be smaller groups, centers, things like that. And we do have, recently we've added some iPads, so we could do whole class instruction with the iPads.
So this is interesting to me because Falmouth, it sounds as though the middle schoolers have iPads, and no, they use the laptops. So in both your school districts, the middle schoolers are still, you're using laptops, you're using iPads. My kids, my middle schooler is using an iPad. If one of you could talk about the thinking behind which is better for a middle school student and a high school student, why one or the other?
Yeah, that's a tough question, I suppose. I mean, I think you'll hear different things from people who use different tools. We made the transition to iPads after 10 years of laptops. What we really liked about them was the portability, the seamlessness of this device. If you think of a laptop, I see a screen in front of me. It creates a little bit of a barrier. We like that teachers make the transition from using the technology to using more traditional educational resources in what we considered was a more fluid way, whereas in the past it was laptops on, laptops off. It seems to be more of a easy transition. We love the portability, the sort of unobtrusiveness of the tablet. It used to be you'd walk, you don't see people walking around with a laptop, but yet I don't think people look at me that strangely when I walk around with this little appendage on my hand called the iPad Mini.
Okay, and why in Falmouth have you stayed with the laptops for middle school?
We went with the MacBook Airs. It was a decision that was made, by a few people, and I believe that children can adapt to anything. I think that we adults are the ones that have the hang-ups. The big decision was basically because of the word processing aspect. And most adults feel that the word processing works a lot better because that's what we're used to. And I've watched kids over the years, and I haven't seen it make a huge difference depending on what they've learned first. And we have kids now who are learning tap typing on iPads, and then they'll walk to a computer and try to type. And to me, the big difference is finding the letters. If you know where the letters are on an iPad, or if you know where the letters are on a keyboard, it really doesn't make a lot of difference. I don't see the kids, if they don't know where the letter P is on an iPad, they don't know where it is on a laptop or a desktop.
It's interesting to me as a mom how quickly things change, because my kids are 13 and 16, and they like keyboards. But I've read and learned as a mom this past year that if kids learn on an iPad and learn on a screen, they end up being faster typers than using a keypad. So my kids at age 16 and 13 are already sort of old school, which is astonishing to me. I mean, what's next?
I have grandchildren and who are 5 and 2, and they have access to iPads, and it amazes me. I remember when my grandson was a year and a half, and he picked up my phone one day, and, you know, it's so intuitive for them. So it will be interesting to see what is around when they are 13, 14, 15. It will be so interesting. I know we're looking at, for a lot of our special education students, the speech-to-text features on the iPads and the iPod touches, iPhones, whatever, and those are coming a long way. There needs to be some more work done with those, but the difference between even 3 years ago and today is amazing.
Jeff, I want to ask you about some of the data about how kids are improving or not improving since we've had this technology in the classroom. 5 years out, there was a study showing that middle schoolers were reading and writing better than they were before the introduction of the laptop initiative. But it seems to me that studies have sort of been mixed since then. Would you agree, or do you believe that this has a tangible impact on kids' performance?
Sure. So I think that, you know, interesting, like to talk to that writing research that you referenced. I think it's really interesting to think about that in light of what Anne was just talking about with the typing. One of the pieces of data that came from that study was we also then looked at things like kids' writing performance on the state tests when they used the laptop versus when they used paper and pencil. Because before the laptop program, of course, the writing sample that eighth graders did for the test every year was paper and pencil. And so we were, of course, concerned that maybe, because the theory then was everyone thought, well, the kids on the laptops will be advantaged because, you know, they can type. It's going to be easier. And what we found was actually there was absolutely no difference, that students who simply had better writing skills performed better, whether they did it on paper or they were typing, which really gets back to it's the skill set, not the medium. Right? So when the kids really do learn to write well, it doesn't really matter what format or what medium they're using to express that writing. Their communication skills have simply improved.
Is most the benefit in writing and reading, or are we seeing this in science and math and, you know,
so you are seeing it all over the place in different ways. I think one of the challenges with the studies is simply that we haven't had enough funding to really dig in and do some of the studies. The other challenge is, of course, to do the studies in the way in which people want to see them, you know, where you kind of have a before and an after. It also presumes that there's a control group. And so then you have to go to a control group, meaning a classroom of kids, and know that you're providing them the placebo. You know, so which parents in Maine want their kids to have the placebo education versus the new education? But we have seen some work done. So we did, for example, in sciences, you ask about science, we had a small study that we did in South Bristol, and we looked at a classroom or a teacher with two different classrooms and his science instruction, and he was looking at planetary motion, and he taught the course the same way to all the kids. But when he had them actually then do the projects to really kind of investigate the concept and to dig into it and demonstrate what they knew and understood, One group used computer animation to try and explain and show what planetary motion was. And the other kids basically drew a poster board as they had for years in his classroom. And what they found was they did a pre and a post. And those kids in the post test that were in the animation group very significantly outscored those in the poster board group. And then 6 weeks later, they did another test to see how they retained that knowledge. And what they found was the kids who had done the work on the computer animation side had very, very little loss. You know, and then it's kind of that typical thing that you would think of, right? Kids oftentimes, all of us, you learn something, but 6 weeks later, if you haven't used it, you don't always remember it quite so well. But these kids had very little loss, whereas the kids who had done the poster board had a pretty significant drop-off in their retention of that understanding. So I think, that, you know, again, this is a science example, one where I think it really did show that here, simply the use of the device in the creation of what essentially we would call a learning artifact, the assignment, right? Really helped because it forced the kids, when they interviewed the kids, they said, well, it was really hard. Well, and of course, but really hard means I had to think about this a lot because I had to make this animation look right. It had to be mathematically accurate as opposed to just kind of going to a poster board and taking a pen and drawing an oval or an ellipse technically, right? And saying, hey, there it is, a planet's moving ellipses.
Mm.
So it really, it confronted them with having to actually wrestle with the real topic, and it gave them an opportunity to do that You know, I don't think any teacher would ask the kids to do animations by hand, like literally the old Disney-style drawing thousands
right.
of cells.
Well, let me ask you about this, and I'll start with you, Andrew. The whole idea of concentration and not jumping from one thing to another. Any of us who works on a screen knows how tempting it is to check your email, to check your, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or whatever, and to be going back and forth. Our producer, Jonathan Smith, I believe, has something like 17 tabs up on his computer at the same time. How do we teach kids to be able to focus on one thing, especially one complicated topic at a time, when they're working on a device that offers them so much and kids are so curious and so sort of so many of them are sort of eager not to sit still anyway?
Sure. Once we figure that out, I'll teach it to myself, because multitasking, I once heard defined by a gentleman at Google, is doing three things at the same time poorly. We think we can multitask, but rarely do we multitask well. Attention to detail and time on task is definitely something that is a casualty, can be a casualty of too much technology. There's no question about it. It's important to look at something called linked multitasking, though, when you can quickly get information that will help you understand another concept. If you want to look up a video that you didn't quite understand what the teacher was trying to get at, that's a good form of multitasking. Checking your texting while you're driving, while you're having a phone conversation, these are dangerous types of multitasking. So what we need to work with kids on, and we're actually working on something to deliberately teach them this executive functioning, which is finding the time to lock yourself out of your notifications. You don't need to know that it's your turn on Words with Friends right now if you're trying to write a three-page essay. So the interesting thing about technology is there's ways that you can put limits on yourself using an iPad or, I'm sure, a Chromebook or even a laptop that will actually take away distractions rather than add distractions. So we need to leverage the features within the systems that allow people to sort of focus, because focus can be a casualty of technology, yes.
Okay, well, on that note, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Hospice of Southern Maine, presenting Twilight in the Park, a celebration of life, Deering Oaks, September 27th. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org. And Five County Credit Union, with 15 local branches, committed to serving your financial needs. Learn more at fivecounty.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Joan Rivers, who has died at the age of 81. We'll listen back to excerpts of our three interviews with her from 1991, 2010, and 2012. Our tribute to Joan Rivers on the next Fresh Air.
You can join us for that program this evening at 7 o'clock here on MPBN. News.mpbn.net is the new news site from MPBN and NPR. It also offers a clean mobile experience. You have a lot of sources, a lot of choices, but news.mpbn.net is the one site for those of you who value and trust the news from public radio, both MPBN and NPR. News.mpbn.net. In-depth coverage of the most important stories taking place in Maine and beyond. Easy to explore and mobile-friendly, whenever and wherever you want.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Technology in Maine Classrooms. With me in the studio, Ann McDonald, who is Technology Integration Specialist for the Falmouth School Department. Jeff Mao, former Learning Technology Policy Director for the Maine Department of Education. He is now Senior Director of Learning Solutions Programs at Common Sense Media. And Andrew Wallace, the Director of Technology for the South Portland School Department. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to Portland and Michael. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Michael.
Hi.
Hi.
So I live in Freeport and work in Portland, and have spent my entire career in technology software, and currently work for a startup technology firm here. And our boys are in third and sixth grade. And a long time ago, we made a decision that, you know, really limiting screen time was important for us and our family. And that meant everything from DVDs and TV at home and computers, iPads, iPhones, et cetera. And, well, my wife and I both went to public schools when we were growing up. There just wasn't an option for us, you know, here in Freeport or the surrounding areas to have that kind of limited screen time. And so we ended up sending our kids to the American East Waldorf School. And it's a school in Freeport that has that same philosophy that, you know, engaging with students in play and art, in theater, and more less screen time and eliminating screen time for younger kids was really important. And so it's an interesting conundrum because, you know, we would love to have a public school experience as well, but that's just not possible. It's not a matter of just using technology in the classrooms. It's about if you make that choice, what are your options? And I wondered if you...
Michael, when you say you limit your kids' screen time, would you limit to nothing, or is it an hour a day? Or what is your philosophy about how much screen time a child should have?
Well, you know, at the early ages, right, it's really eliminating it. And, you know, we don't watch movies. We took a trip a few years ago down to Washington, D.C., and our friends were blown away that we didn't have an iPad or a DVD player in the car, even though it was a 10-hour journey. And so really for us, elimination of that is at a young age is really important. And then as they grow older, you know, learning ways to use technology is important. It was funny, I read an article in the New York Times about the Waldorf School of the Peninsula, and they have a number of executives from Google and Apple and other technology companies there. And somebody said, well, isn't that a little hypocritical? I mean, you're creating all of this technology that kids are using. And the executive at Apple said, well, you know, if I made rated R movies, I wouldn't necessarily send my 3-year-old to it. So I find that there's...
Okay, you know, Michael, we have a bunch of calls, so I'm going to try to get our guests to have a chance to respond to you. I'm not sure that, I mean, you all are not setting up the schools in Maine and deciding who gets to use technology and who doesn't. But in your school districts, is there an option for students who, parents who really don't want their kids to have a lot of screen time?
I wouldn't say that there was an option, but I am a former science teacher, and I think there's a misperception on how much we actually use technology. We use it as a tool. So, for example, when we were learning about density in the classroom, we weren't using laptops. Once in a while, after we did all the hands-on and things like that, then we might do a simulation. We would use it for data collection. We'd use it as a tool. So instead of taking a pen and writing on a paper form, they would collect the data in a spreadsheet on the laptop. And that's about it. So I think that there's a misperception of how much screen time there really is. I mean, I think most teachers think of it as a tool. It's just a tool that replaces, at times, paper and pencil. But it doesn't even always replace paper and pencil. And I think there's a fallacy, a perception that teachers sit kids in front of computers all day, and they really don't. I think if you added up the screen time, if you really came into a school and really watched the amount of time, it's much, much less than people think. But as for none, we don't have that option, but then again, we've never been asked. So I don't know what we would do in that situation. And at the lower grades, it's much different than at the upper grades.
Michael, thanks for your call. Headed to Kristen, who's from the American League High School in New Gloucester. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just calling because I think that I'm a high school humanities teacher. I teach English and history here at the Waldorf High School. And I know that one question we often get from families is, you know, will our child be able to use the technology if they're not exposed to the screen early on? There's a perception that they're not building the skills they need in order to go out and meet the future, especially when they attend college. And I guess I just want to give my perspective, which is that does not seem to be an issue at all with our students, that what we find is that the fact that they have the creative thinking skills and the social skills that come from face-to-face interactions in the classroom and focusing on building that skill set that translates over into exactly the type of critical thinking and creative skills that are necessary in IT. And so a number of our graduates actually go on to IT careers, and all of our students, by the time they're in high school, are perfectly capable of using technology. So I wonder, I guess, maybe this would be a question for some of your guests. Do you see a sort of gradual pushback of the use of technology into earlier and earlier grades? And if so, what is the evidence that using technology, iPads, et cetera, in the very early years of schooling, what's the evidence that that has an advantage over starting it later, let's say?
Okay, Jeff?
So I think it's an interesting question to ask, and I think what we've seen is that increasingly more and more schools are starting to introduce the technology at younger ages, but in very targeted fashions. And we actually have a rather newsworthy district, you know, in the Auburn schools, who were the first that we know of in kind of a significant way to introduce the iPads to kindergartners across their entire district. But their efforts were very targeted, specific to literacy. And again, they don't do it all day long, but they had some specific tasks they were looking at, and they are in the process now of actually gathering that data with a hope that, the logic model being that by the time these students reach third and fourth grade, that hopefully that their reading skills universally will be improved and better, in the aggregate than they had been in the past because of the overall cost, and we all know the negative realities of what happens to a student as they progress through the ages when their reading skills aren't so good. The challenges for that child. And so really trying to hammer those skills and get them really down at an early age is really the goal there. I think the most important thing to consider in all of this is that the goal of providing the technology to kids in schools is not to teach them IT. And it's not necessarily to try and produce the next engineers who are going to work for Apple or Dell or Microsoft or something like that. It's to produce well-educated kids. And so some of the goals that you outlined are exactly the same goals that I know are happening in the Falmouth schools and at Ann schools and at Andy schools in South Portland and schools across the state. Everyone's looking for ways to engage kids and ways to create problem solvers and critical thinkers. And as necessary and as appropriate, they're trying to leverage that technology to help improve that universally for all the kids. And so for some kids, it means doing different things. And that's one of the beauties of it is that not every student does the exact same thing with the technology. But for some kids, there's certain things that the technology can do for them that aids them and keeps them in a level playing field with their classmates.
I'd add that with technology, too, the teachers now have the ability to differentiate the instruction to meet the kids where their needs are at a level that was previously almost impossible. Like I could assign a reading assignment to Jeff that was at the third grade level and give the same general concept to Jennifer at the eighth grade level, and neither would know the difference. I can do that very simply with certain technologies and websites and software. So the teacher can be much more effective. So the teacher angle on why we should be doing this at a lower level, to me, is as compelling as the student argument.
Well, Kristen, thanks so much for your call. Something you said earlier, Anne, I've been thinking about is you talked about how there's very little screen time, actually. And this is, the technology is almost additive. And that's one thing I've been, you didn't use the word additive, I am. It's in addition to the experiments, the textbooks. And you know, Jeff, you and I had a conversation several years ago where people are talking about textbooks being a thing of the past, you know, where kids had these light backpacks, you know, with just their iPad or just their laptop. And what I've seen with my own kids is they have a backpack full of books and their laptop or iPad. And you know, boy, if they have a musical instrument on top of that, it's just getting around with all this stuff is a challenge, never mind the broader philosophical questions. Do you still see a day when perhaps textbooks are a thing of the past, or is that no longer the thinking?
No, I do still see that coming. I mean, books will always exist. But I think the dependence on those books is going to continue to decrease. And I think across our schools, you can see that dependence is still dropping. One of the challenges is that the availability of high-quality content in any form, digital or otherwise, and then also that information and curricula organized into what we would call a curriculum, not just information, is not necessarily easy to find on the internet. And so we've been working across the state and across the country on trying to help pull together some of those digital resources to make it easier. And in fact, I know that I may be jumping the gun a little bit, but I know in my last few weeks at the Department of Education, we received a $500,000 grant here in the state of Maine to do exactly that, to try and work with teachers across the state to build digital textbooks and to build them in such a way that the use of the technology in that curricula isn't purely additive, but actually, as we would kind of, you know, it's a kind of a catchphrase nowadays, but, you know, totally and fully integrated in a sense that the technology just becomes seamless and it's leveraged in ways that are useful and not simply just reading it on the screen versus reading it on paper. But I do think it's coming. It's just it's a long road, and the publishing industry itself is still trying to sort this out themselves, but they're making good progress as well, trying to figure out how to do digital content. And as Andy was saying, allow us to be able to differentiate. So having a system that's not one book that represents, say, seventh grade math, but instead a large collection of content that's organized in a fashion but is also flexible so that Andy could give me a slightly different assignment than he gives to Anne because of our levels.
Great. Going to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I taught physics for a number of years, and I can think of a myriad of places where I would like to be able to assign students to watch various movies because you don't have the equipment. But that's not the real reason I wanted to talk. Many, many years ago in a land far away, I was watching, I believe it was Omnibus, and I believe it was Alistair Cook sent us to Ireland. And the guy was driving around Ireland saying all this, showing all this neat junk about Ireland. And then he drove into this ditch. And on the ditch, the bottom of the ditch, there was a sign that says no entry. And the guy said, you know, this is Northern Ireland, and trying to get between Northern Ireland and Ireland is a real pain in the butt. And then about 15 years later, I was lying in a bed with my knees in traction, and I heard Ian Paisley on the TV railing against how disgusting Catholics are. And with the internet, you know, I could immediately have typed in Northern Ireland and Ireland and what's the problem and been told. So for, you know, many, many, many years, I didn't know what was going on. Now our own Mandela, Senator Mitchell, managed to stop the problem, but you know, there's just myriad of things that are accessible to people now with the internet that, you know, as a, you know, 8-9-year-old kid, there's no way I could have done it.
Well, and I think that's what, Andrew, you were referring to when you're talking about good kind of connected multitasking, how a student can be working on a paper and go to all sorts of sources with one click and find out information that would have just been almost impossible to find as a middle school or high school student before.
Yeah, I remember as a former librarian, one of the things, an exercise we used to do with kids all the time, some of the earliest websites were the major newspapers, so like Le Monde or Der Spiegel. So you'd have kids read different newspapers from different countries to get different points of views on the same topic. Now you can go one step deeper. You can read the Twitter feeds of the people in the streets in Syria or anywhere else where there's a conflict or a difference of opinions. And students really can become more global citizens that can make their own decisions rather than just take for, you know, as the truth what they read in a particular newspaper, which may or may not have a bent.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Larry. We're going to go to another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. And Casella, committed to effectively managing non-recyclable waste while protecting the environment. Casella, giving resources new life.
Climate One is a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. To understand any of them, you have to understand them all. I'm Greg Dalton. Our next program focuses on the fracking boom sweeping across America. Supporters of fracking for natural gas say it's good for the economy and it's cleaner than coal. Detractors point to poison water tables and claim it may actually be dirtier than coal. A debate about fracking on the next Climate One.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 1 o'clock.
Hey, it's David Green here. The last car I owned was a navy blue Volkswagen Jetta. It was about 10 years ago, and it was hugely problematic. It had this window problem where sometimes the entire driver's side window would slide down into the door. Not cool when it's cold outside or raining. Crazy to think that even that car could be turned into the programs that I love.
For more information, visit mpbn.net and click on the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program button in the top left corner. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Classroom Technology. With me in the studio, Andrew Wallace, who's Director of Technology for the South Portland School Department. Ann McDonald, Technology Integration Specialist for the Falmouth School Department. And Jeff Mao, he was the former Learning Technology Policy Director for the Maine Department of Education. He's now the Senior Director of Learning Solutions Programs at Common Sense Media. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566, headed to Leeds. And Richard, hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'd like to ask your panel, how early or do you start teaching Internet security? You know, when you were a little child, I'm sure all of you were taught that you don't run with scissors and that when you get to the street, you look both, stop and look both ways. And the thing is, the earlier you teach children about using a password and Internet security, the better it is for them because they're going to end up having that. It'll just be like brushing their teeth, you know, something that's automatic. If you take a look at what's been happening lately with the Jennifer Lawrence thing and all of this that's going on, and you look at how many children are susceptible to what's going on in the Internet and whatnot, I'm just curious to know if you do that. And I'd also make a bet that most of you or all of you do not even use a password manager so that you can have highly encrypted passwords, do you?
So anyway, Richard, I will send your question out to the panelists. I know that my own kids not only have passwords, but really hard to memorize passwords. I have to write them down and keep them with me. What do you do in the Falmouth schools, Ann?
We start teaching formally in third grade about passwords, and probably we should be moving that back to second. But and the kids love it. I know there's something about creating passwords. We talk about creating passwords that are safe and not using your name, and they really enjoy learning about passwords. And we just stress, don't share your passwords with anyone, and we start as early as we can. They don't have a lot of important passwords at that stage, you know, they have passwords to get onto different things that aren't that important. It's just the idea of learning how to use them, how to create them, and things like that.
And how about online safety, Andrew?
Similarly, third grade is the entry point. I'm pretty sure we'll be pushing it back to second grade. Third grade is generally when we give the kids their own passwords and accounts, but the push is already coming for grade two. And Jeff actually probably can speak even better to this topic with Common Sense Media is a resource that many of our schools use to teach kids how to be safe online and how to navigate the web securely and safely.
Sure. So I hope this doesn't sound too self-serving since I am just starting up with this organization. But yeah, Common Sense Media has been providing these kinds of materials, both curricula for kids as well as curricula for parents to help teach them about these things and how to work with their kids. And that begins at kindergarten and even earlier. I know with my own son, my oldest son, I remember when he was probably only about 2.5, we started this process. In fact, just simply to teach him our home phone number, I made his password on our home computer our phone number. So he had to memorize this 10-digit string of numbers. But this way we told him, well, now that you've memorized that, if you're ever lost, you can tell someone what our phone number is. Of course, you know, later when he needed an internet password, we said, well, let's not use that one. That's not a good one. But there are curricula and pieces that can start as early as kindergarten and earlier. And I think the best thing is, as Andy was saying, you know, over 90% of schools in Maine leverage the Common Sense Media products. They're all free, and so that's one of the nice parts. It's a nonprofit organization just out there dedicated to helping kids. And so I think that's a great question. It is something that we take very seriously, and we do impress upon the schools the necessity of it. It is, in fact, part of the agreement that schools sign when they choose to participate in the statewide one-to-one programs. It's something that's federally mandated. And so I think all of our schools do a great job of making sure that they provide both internet safety, security training, as well as what we would call digital citizenship, just how to be a good person online, realizing that you could say something that could spread wildly that maybe you shouldn't have said.
Yeah, and Richard hit on something too, and I want to stress that it's not when do we start, but do you do it often, and you have to reinforce it and teach different angles of it. You know, it might be password security at the lower levels. It might be cyberbullying or bullying at the middle school level. And it might be, am I acting in a way online that will get me into a good college or prevent me from having a job? So you have to keep doing it at different levels. The core is the same, being a responsible, safe, you know, user of the internet. But the implications are different at different levels. And we can't just say, check, we've done it. It's something we have to do often.
Yeah. And I know you talked about how things have changed since the beginning of the MLTI program. That's something that I think when we started, I don't think teachers did do a very good job of it in 2002, because I don't think it was really, we weren't thinking of it as adults. And I think now it's changed dramatically. And as Jeff has mentioned, Common Sense Media has wonderful educational materials for teachers and parents.
All right, Richard, thanks for your call. Going to an email from Keith, he writes, "Dear panel, with recent discussions about the educational advantages of more frequent quizzes and testing, if these advantages are in fact true, how would high-tech devices contribute to that? There's another concern that persons who take time to photograph their experiences tend to have less accurate recall." Andrew, you're nodding. You know where this question's coming from?
No, I don't actually know. I'm okay, interested in that research. Sorry. I was nodding like, oh, that sounds interesting. But I will say with, the more frequent and less formal quizzes and what we call checks for understanding, that technology makes that so simple that, you know, the teacher doesn't have to be the teacher of my memory lugging home that massive beanbag tote with papers to grade. You can self-grade quizzes using Google Docs, free resources, and you could give a quiz 5 times a day if you felt so inclined. But it's also really important for teachers, and our teachers do a great job of checking in with the kids, making sure that their pacing is correct, that the kids understand it, and without all the formality of like a pop quiz. You can very quickly push out a quiz to all the kids in the class and have it self-graded, and the teacher can then take that assessment and augment their teaching to meet the needs of the kids and their levels of understanding.
I think it goes now with the technology a step further in that there is more assessment occurring in many systems that kids don't even recognize as assessment. So when we used to go home and do the problems in our math book, you know, do 1 to 29 odd, you did those problems in a vacuum at home. And I mean, not a total vacuum. I remember when I grew up, it was on the phone with your friends. Hey, did you get number 6? I'm kind of confused. And then your friend says, well, you're supposed to do 1 to 29 odd, Jeff. You know, don't even bother with 6. But nonetheless, you know, you did those problems. And it wasn't until you got back to class the next day that you could raise your hand and say, you know, I got confused. I didn't know how to do this problem. The technology now allows you to do those problems and immediately determine, did you get this right or wrong? And then start to provide you hints if you weren't quite right, direct you to resources that might help clarify that understanding. And then on the backside of all of that, the teacher can get all of that data so that they can get a snapshot walking into the classroom before the kids are even there to see, well, how did the kids do on homework last night? And know whether they need to reteach a lesson or which groups of kids they want to pull aside and reteach that lesson, and other kids maybe they can allow to advance forward. Whereas before, we used to do that 5-minute at the beginning of the class check-in where I'd say, here, do these 3 problems on the board, and then you'd kind of have to use up some more time. Okay, did everyone? How did you guys do in show of hands on number 1? And try and determine quickly by just kind of staring at everyone's face whether or not they understood. And this really gives you a much more deep way of understanding where the kids are at and being able to help them and make sure that they don't kind of fall through the cracks.
And it also lets you get at the kids who wouldn't necessarily raise their hands in class. So you can ask a question online and see the results, and that child in the back who wouldn't answer the question, you're now going to be able to see what their thinking is.
Okay, going to Amos in Lewiston. Hi, Amos, go ahead.
Hi, I was just calling because I was listening. It's the first time I called in the name calling. I was actually a middle school student in 2002 when we got that first wave of laptops, and then in high school I was in the student tech program, so I was kind of at the front lines of that whole time. And I was just wanted to comment on my experience with it was that a lot of people said, well, you know, we shouldn't be giving kids these, you know, laptops worth hundreds of dollars. They're kids. They're just going to break them. But I found that once the students actually had laptops and were taking them home and it was their laptop, that they actually treated them a lot better because, you know, when it broke, they didn't have a laptop anymore to do, and it made assignments a lot more difficult. So I found that it seemed to be teaching the kids a lot more about responsibility and taking care of their own property and stuff like that. And I just was wondering if that's something that is kind of like a statewide thing that other people have been noticing as well.
Yeah, thanks for those comments. You are that, as we always in the office would refer to, as the first MLTI babies. And it's great to hear that you had a positive experience. And I think what you saw is exactly what we saw statewide. In fact, when we began the program, one of the things that we made optional, because there was so much fear around this idea, as you said, of giving a student who was 12 years old a $1,000 laptop, was we told the schools, you have an option. You can let the kids take them home or not. And what we saw into the third year was that, statistically speaking, the schools that weren't sending them home were the ones with the higher rates of damage. And they were the schools where the teachers and the kids had kind of less buy-in. And so that's when in 2006, when we did the second kind of wave of devices, the State Department decided, we're going to mandate this. And we told the schools, if you want to participate, you have to let the kids take these home so that there is that ownership. And I think it's been positive ever since then. And we still see, you know, very, very small numbers as far as loss and damage, you know, as a percentage basis. And, you know, I think it's exactly as you described. The kids take ownership of it. They recognize the value of it. It's useful for their education. And when kids are learning and engaged, they take care of things because it's important to them.
Amos, thanks for your call. Headed to the Midcoast. And Angie, hi, Angie.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I teach in the Midcoast, and I am taking my daughter to college today, which is why I'm able to hear your show.
Oh, great.
I think that it's important for people to be mindful and understand the difference between what we do in the school setting with computers and laptops and what people see their kids doing at home on their own personal laptops and computers. So if the students in my room are going home and spending even half the time doing interactive multiplication.com or watching Simple Machines and how they work and what have you, as opposed to video games where they're very passively involved instead of being outside running around getting fresh air and having healthy snacks, I think that we would get the best of both worlds. So what goes on in the classroom is very interactive for all students simultaneously, and what happens at home is more of a passive, not really the best thing in my mind, what's best for students.
Well, I think our guests are agreeing with you, Angie. I'm seeing lots of nods. Thanks so much for taking the time to call in on your big trip today. Thank you. And we have time, I think, for one more comment. This is from the Maine Calling Facebook page, and Wayne, he writes, computers are not the only technology in the schools. Can we talk about the use of interactive whiteboards in the Tandberg video conferencing units that have been put into most of the schools through rural utility service grants from the USDA? The telepresence in particular is a tool with great potential that has been underutilized or in some cases not utilized in many districts.
Well, both of those two different systems, I think, have been used in some places to great ends, and in other places, as the commenter said, aren't getting used as much as they could be. I think one of the challenges that many schools have faced with the Tanbergs, for example, which is a video conferencing system, is that oftentimes it required a lot of extra scheduling because it physically existed in a place in the school. And I think with the advent of mobile computers that had their own webcams on them, like the iPads or the MacBooks, that they didn't need that room because you can do it right from your computer or right from your iPad now. And so the functionality that they provide, I think, is being leveraged, but maybe not by that particular tool. In fact, to some degree, the Tanberg is something that works really well in a corporate setting. You go to a conference room and have a meeting. But in a classroom setting, as kind of the previous caller was saying, what we do in the classroom is a little bit different. And the way kids interact with technology is a little bit different. And so they are leveraging the functionality of what a Tanberg brought, just doing it in different ways. And I think the same thing with smart boards. One of the things that people love about the smart board is the idea it's a whiteboard, like you would see, or a chalkboard in the front of a room, but you can touch it and interact with your computer. And that's exactly what I think a lot of folks really love about the tablets, is that now every student who has one of these has their own touch surface and can interact with that computing interface versus maybe one child at a time at the front of the room. Now you've got all the kids who can be independently doing work that's specific to them. It may be doing the same assignment, but again, at their own pace, and the computer reacting to their input and giving them information that's timely for them.
Yeah. And I know we use Skype a lot at our school, and we have a lot of teachers who are part of the Mystery Skype program, or Skype for Teachers. And in a Mystery Skype, the classrooms get together, sometimes two or three classrooms, and they get together, and they don't know where the other classroom is, and the kids have to ask questions to figure it out. And there's so many things that you can do with video conferencing, but that you don't need anymore the actual room where we use the laptops, the iPads. We had a teacher a few years ago who had, instead of when parents couldn't come in or grandparents couldn't come into the classroom, they would have them read stories over Skype with grandparents that were in another state.
Wow. Well, that's going to have to be an interesting conversation. Ann McDonald, Technology Integration Specialist for the Falmouth School Department. Jeff Mao was, until last week, Learning Technology Policy Director for the Maine Department of Education. His new job is Senior Director of Learning Solutions Programs at Common Sense Media. Andrew Wallace is the Director of Technology for the South Portland School Department. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and our intern, Joshua Gauthier, answered your calls. Our volunteer, Cindy Hahn, helped produce today's program. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, just in time for fall migration, a look at birding. Join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about which birds to look for and where you might find them as many begin their trek south for the winter. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.